Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much for that news update, Greg. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock right now on this day, the 29th of October. Back in 1888, a gentleman by the name of Cecil Rhodes would be granted a charter for the British South Africa Company by the UK. In 1889, a year later, Queen Victoria would sign off on that as well. In 1922 on this day, Benito Mussolini would be appointed the Prime Minister of Italy. 1929 on this day, the stock market crash known as Black Tuesday, yes, it happened on a Tuesday in 1929, would trigger the Great Depression. In 1982, on this day, a gentleman by the name of John DeLorean would be indicted for drug trafficking. He would later be acquitted. If that name sounds familiar, yes, it's the one and only founder of the DeLorean Motor Group. In 1982, on the same year, Michael Jackson and Sir Paul McCartney would decide who the girl belonged to. The Girl Is Mine would be released on this day in history. In 2001, on this day, ExxonMobil, the US company, would plan to spend $4 billion as part of a consortium of investment companies that would be developing oil and gas fields in, wait for it, Russia. In 2012 on this day, Penguin and a Random House would merge, forming the largest publisher in the world. 2015 on this day, China would end its one-child policy after 35 years in implementation. And in 2023 on this day, Turkey would celebrate 100 years of its independence. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we're taking a look at budget expectations. We've got a conversation with Kanti Pai of PwC around those expectations for tomorrow's midterm budget policy statement from National Treasury. We've also got a conversation with Peter Major around the gold and silver ratio, understanding that and understanding why it matters now. Then we've got a conversation with Old Mutual Corporate, speaking to their SME department around the innovations they've put in place for SMEs and how they're pushing SMEs into the future. And then, because it's Tuesday, we've got Property Tuesday this week, not Agri Tuesday. We're going to be taking a look at the state of the rental market in South Africa. There's a report that's put together by a company called TPN. We're going to be speaking to them and trying to understand their quarterly report and what it suggests about the rental space.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we kick off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's been a very interesting day of movements, some surprisingly good movements, some not so good. I'm joined on the line by founder at Just One Lap and good friend Simon Brown to take a look at the market movements throughout the day. Good evening, Si. Thanks so much for taking the time. I don't even know where to start, but I suppose we could start with the fact that the commodities prices seem to be playing ball, whether you're looking at gold prices, oil prices, PGM prices, everything on the commodities front seems to be looking good.
Evening, Jimmy. 100%. And we've got gold trading at all-time highs as we speak. We have got oil going down back into the low 70s after spiking again last week. That, of course, Brent crude we're talking about. And then PGMs. I mean, platinum holding up above 1,000, but the bigger one, perhaps palladium above 1,200. Palladium driven, there was the theory floated from the US last week that the G7 nations should sanction Russian palladium. That got palladium markets very excited. And then as well, the Inflation Reduction Act out of the US is going to grant some essentially forward payments to PGM producers. And of course, Sibanye-Stillwater has some assets which in Montana, they've currently mothballed them, but they could bring those back online. And that would certainly help with cash flow. So it has been a commodity week. And as you say, all moving in the right directions.
You bring up Sibanye, and I just remember they also structured that deal as well on the prepayment of the gold as well. So if they're able to pull this off with their Montana assets, that would probably allow for them to unmothball them and continue production. They understanding that they are guaranteed those revenues. That might be an interesting movement, because the share price on Sibanye has moved around quite a bit since that announcement. But speaking of share prices that have moved, there's been a couple of announcements locally as well. And I want to start with perhaps the positives. ShopRite gave us an update today. The share price, absolutely loving that update. Really front running most of the markets today.
Yeah, I mean, ShopRite's a beast. The share was up over 5%. It didn't go into a lot of detail. It is the sort of 9 months to September update. A couple of key points. I mean, revenue is growing at north of 10%. Internal inflation is below 3%. So inflation continues to track down, and they continue to aggressively open stores. And this is important because what we're seeing from Pick and Pay, who are going the other way, and even if we look at Boxer, which Pick and Pay will spin out next month, even the Boxer rate of openings are slower than what ShopRite is doing. And it's not just your traditional sort of ShopRite Checkers, Usave. It's Petsense. It's Checkers Outdoor. Those sort of unique, the niche brands that they are truthfully having a try at, and let's see how it works is kind of their philosophy. And if it works, they'll in time have 500, 1,000 of those stores around, much like they do with their liquor stores. And if it doesn't, well, you know, no harm, no foul. We tried, and we'll move on. A strong update. No news on things such as, you know, what are we seeing in operating margins and the like, and volumes. But my sense from looking at it is that they're seeing volume growth, which means they're taking market share, undoubtedly from Pick and Pay, and they're probably maintaining their very strong operating margins of around 5%.
The nice thing about ShopRite is pretty soon they're going to give us an update. We're going to find out what's going on there, and we're going to get more color on those numbers. But let's look at some of the guys that didn't have such a good day, from 5% in the green to 5% or more in the red. Astoria Investments is listed on the JSE. They gave us an update, but it came with a cautionary, and the market was down about 6% on the day. What was in that update?
Update in of itself was meh. I mean, the numbers are going backwards. The HEPS is up, but NAV is really the important number there. That has weakened, the net asset value going the wrong way. They have had an offer for one of their businesses. They make the point that they are, you know, because it's only looking to buy it at around the price that it's held on their books. They're obviously looking for a premium in that regard. It is a thinly traded. When the SENSE announcement first came out, I was looking at the stock and there was no activity happening. So there's not a lot of volume going through. So we can see some outsized moves coming. But I think all in all, I think the market was just expecting slash hoping that they were going to get a better update and certainly a better price if they're selling assets. You know, selling it at your value, you want premiums.
We seem to be losing you a bit there, Syme. I'm going to ask you to just move around a little bit there and see if we can get a better line through to you. And while we are looking at that, the news that we got today, a 13 billion rand deal off the table. Competition Commission has decided that the Vodacom acquisition of Massive is not going ahead, much to the disappointment of the Remgro family, which would have seen the share price come down quite heavily today as well. Any particular reasons why the Competition Commission didn't like this deal?
Yeah, so this is an old deal. It's back to 2021. I'd actually, to be perfectly honest, I'd forgotten about it until those SENSE announcements from Vodacom and from Remgro came out. The argument from the Competition Commission is quite simple, is that they were looking to buy a 30% stake in the fiber operator, it's Dog Fiber Africa and some other assets. They were going to inject some other assets into the business as well, again, the sort of fiber business, which would give them a controlling stake. And the Competition Commission said, hang on a sec, you are the largest telco in the country, and now you want to have a controlling interest in one of the largest fiber providers in the country. Fair play. I'm not surprised that they turned it down. The arguments that Vodacom was making about rolling out and going to rural areas, with respect, these are stories we've heard before. We've heard them from some of their competitors. We've heard them from Vodacom, and it would have given them significant clout in a space. The flip side is that if we look at data as a utility, then there is. I look at it, we've got Vodacom, we've got MTN, we've got the Telkom, we've got Cell C, we've got Rain out there who are offering data but might move into voice at some point. And I don't think our market's big enough for four operators. The US had four and there was some consolidation and they're now operating on three primary telcos. We might simply have too many, but the Competition was having none of it. They were like, nope, we're worried about the concentration, particularly in fiber provisions.
Si, while the line is holding up with us, I want to quickly touch on the Coronation trading update. We know that, or trading statement rather, we know that Coronation recently won their court case against SARS. We expected that there might be an announcement of a special dividend following that victory. What does the trading statement say?
Yeah, so the trading statement, and there's two parts to it. The one is that if you include the provision that they had set aside for the SARS judgment, which they won, so they don't have to provision, if you include that, the numbers are up staggering, plus 200%. But that's not a fair reflection. They took it out last year, put it aside, then I'll put it back in. To me, the core numbers was the 0 to 10%, and you know, that's without any of the SARS numbers going through, and that is modest growth. I would expect an asset manager, our market, Jimmy, is up more than 10% in the period, and you would expect them to at least track that to maybe what's a little flat, and maybe the problem they run, you are at 600 kind of assets under management, it's hard to really move the needle. You know, you might have one or two funds doing really good and earning you performance fees, but you know, how much of that 600 billion are they?
That's a very interesting perspective. Are the asset managers underperforming where they should be outperforming in the current economic climate? Thank you so much, Si, for the time and for the insights. That was Simon Brown, founder at Just One Lap, sharing his thoughts on some of the market movements and SENS announcements that we got out today. We apologize for the bad line there. It seems technology was trying to play the villain, but we won't allow it. We'll continue on.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This year, more voters have headed to the polls than ever before. This has brought political change to key markets, which will inevitably impact the long-term outlook for global markets more broadly. Tune in to the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening as Simon Skinner, Head of Global Investments at Orbis, discusses the changes in risk-to-reward profiles of global markets and compelling opportunities for long-term investors. Brought to you by Alan Gray. Long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Perhaps the gremlins have something to do with that Vodacom deal not going through. It is a 13 billion rand deal after all. But we're going to be looking at the interesting relationship between some metals, because the commodities conversations are clearly in focus. As you heard earlier with my conversation with Simon Brown, there's a lot of interest in the commodities market, depending on which commodities you're looking at. But there's always been a very interesting relationship that we're going to dig into a little bit more now. I'm joined on the line by the director for mining at the Modern Corporate company called Modern Corporate Solutions, Peter Major, to take a look at the relationship between gold and silver. Good evening, Peter. Thanks so much for taking the time. It's a very interesting relationship that dates back to probably before I was even born. It's decades old. But why have these two metals in particular always been closely linked?
Look, to be honest, there's a very tenuous relationship, because in different periods of time, there was a national government that said, we will give you so much money for silver, and we'll give you 16 times as much money for gold. And that was the United States. From 1792 until about 1882, you know, for roughly 90 years, silver and gold were supposed to trade at the same price, at the same ratio, 16 to 1. But then the Americans discovered this rich Comstock lode in about 1860, just about the time of the Civil War. And there was so much silver coming out that people were taking silver and buying gold with it. And the U.S. thought, geez, if the world's going to get flooded with silver, they're going to buy all the gold. And it was draining gold from the central bank. And so in 1873, the government said, we're not going to exchange it at a 16 to 1 ratio. We're going to let silver find its own level. And that's pretty much what's happened since 1873. It's found its own level. And usually the level was a lot worse than 16 to 1. It was 20 to 1, and then 30 to 1, and then 40 to 1. And then the gold price was controlled for a while. So from 1934 until about 1974, for roughly 40 years, the gold price stayed at $35 an ounce. But the silver, it went up with inflation like a lot of the other metals. And so all of a sudden, gold was looking very cheap again, and people were using, foreigners were using silver to buy gold. And then President Nixon said, hey, we're not going to support the gold price. So literally since 1972, 73, all metals have traded freely. But lots of people like to say, well, there should be a link. Now, I'm an engineer, so if you say, what would an engineer calculate? I would say, well, there's 100 million ounces of year gold being produced out of the mines. And there's about 850 million ounces of silver being produced out of the mines. So that tells me on a yearly basis, the ratio should maybe be 8.5 to 1. I'm sure everybody who has silver would love to hear that. But it's a nebulous argument. But if you just go on how much is produced every year, yes, there's 8.5 times more silver being produced than gold. And yet today's price is 80 to 1. So that does seem like a very big gap between what's being produced, 80 to 1.
Peter, when we think about this relationship, it's a very interesting relationship because both metals kind of are very in-demand metals in the world. It's not as though one doesn't have any use or one is purely a store of value. Both go into jewelry, both go into manufacturing, both go into various use cases. And I guess the conversation then is around the correlation between the two. Is we've seen often that when we look at things like gold valuations, if something is a 24 karat gold or an 18 karat or 9 karat, there are other components that go into that. And now you're seeing the rise of metals like copper and other sorts of things that come into these conversations. What does this mean for the future of gold and silver? Are they going to continue to have such a close relationship, or do you see it kind of drifting further and further apart as the world develops?
No, I think they will get closer together. Because gold is valued so highly, even if you have a gold coin, even in America, $2,750. Well, if you just want to go to the supermarket, it's going to be hard to get change for $2,750. Whereas if you have a silver coin, it's worth $34. So you can buy quite a few groceries and put 4 or 5 silver coins on the table, and that's enough. So, and a lot of countries are using silver more and more for money. And the Americans, funny enough, a third of the silver produced by the world goes into investments in America, in other words, something like 300 million ounces a year goes into investment in America. So America's, and they're taking it in silver bars. So the Americans are definitely treating it like a currency. The Indians, that are rumored to have over 2 billion ounces stockpiled, they treat it as a real savings vehicle. So I think silver has much more uses of money than any other metal except probably gold. But if you want to go into scarcity value, you could say, well, gee, platinum, on a production side, the world only produces 6 to 7 million ounces a year of platinum, and they produce 100 million ounces of gold. So, gee, does that mean platinum should be, what's 100 divided by 6? You know, 15 to 17. You know, maybe platinum should be 17 times more valuable than gold because it's not being produced very much. And palladium's probably the same ratio. You know, the world probably produces 6-7 million ounces a year of palladium. We did see a big jump in all precious metals this week. We've seen palladium go from below almost $1,000 to $1,250. We've seen platinum go from below $1,000 to, let's see here, $10,050. So it hasn't moved so much, but yeah, most precious metals, they kind of move in tandem, but there's gaps between them. Like if we say, what's gold done relative to silver the last 10 years? Well, it's gotten up to 110 times the silver price, and it's fallen as low as 35, 40 times the silver price. So they call it arbitraging. If you see the gold price get above 80 or 90, you say, gee, I know it's going to return to some kind of mean, so I'm going to sell gold and buy silver with it. And then if gold falls down to maybe 70-1 ratio or 66-1, you say, the odds are it's going to go back up, so I'm going to reverse. I'm going to sell my silver and buy gold with it. But that's for somebody that sits at a screen all the time and reads tea leaves and checks, is it a full moon or a half moon? There is no mechanistic regular formula to what these metals should trade at.
Peter, how do we then determine what is too cheap or too undervalued? I mean, you alluded to the fact that the ratio should be closer to 8-1 based on production, and that's a sound measurement metric.
Yes.
I suppose it's a very logical way to approach it from an engineer, but we know that markets often operate in a very illogical fashion. How do we then justify that silver is still so cheap, or that gold is so expensive, or that some metals are priced at what they're priced at? How do we know what we're dealing with here?
It's very much on personal or perceived demand or lack of demand. And I think we can learn something from diamonds. Man can now produce perfect diamonds that only a real expert can tell the difference between them. They're just as hard. They're even more pure, more clear, and we can produce larger and larger sizes. So now we're producing real wedding ring size and grade diamonds. And the production cost of those diamonds is somewhere between 5 and 10% of the production cost of a real diamond that's unearthed that might have even a defect or two in it. So you say, okay, why hasn't the price of the earthbound, the ones dug out of the earth, why hasn't the price of those diamonds utterly collapsed? And hey, it might be going there. I see diamonds on average are selling at $83 a carat now, rough. And a couple of years ago, they were selling at $115. So these are pretty low prices. I've seen $83, $85 for rough, I swear, 10, 20 years ago. So that shows diamonds haven't come up in 20 years. At least the silver price has come up in 20 years. And we all know the gold price has. So it's perception. Perception turns into reality. So if people perceive that a expensive diamond was dug out of the ground, whether it's 1 carat, 2 carats, or 3 carats, if they perceive that makes it more genuine or more rare than one made in a high-pressure steel canister, but then how much are they willing to pay for that one as to one that looks almost the same and weighs the same and costs 5 or 10%? I don't have the answers for this. It's scary. If you're a producer, it's scary because you might be making a lot of money today. You might be going broke tomorrow, or you may be going broke today based on what you're producing, and you throw in the towel, sell your machines, close shop, and then you find out it reverts to a much higher level tomorrow, and then you kick yourself. So reversion to the mean is always a good place to start. You don't have to stay there, but just statistically, that's how businesses are run nowadays, especially in the States. Everything's based on statistics. So if you say the average price of the last 10 years of silver, gold is 80-1, maybe it's going to revert closer to the 50-year average that was 66-1. So, but is it going to revert there overnight? Is it going to revert there and stay there? Is it going to revert there over a period of years? You don't know. It's risky. It's risky, especially taking borrowed money or hard saved money and just saying, I'm going to go on this side of the curve. Because if you're wrong, you could lose it, or you could just have it frozen for a long time. But I wish I could give you a more logical explanation of these metals, but industrial demand and personal bias has a lot to do with it, but those are nebulous factors. They're hard to get a handle on.
Certainly some interesting things to think about, especially when we look at the relationship between these metals and between generally anything that trades around the world. Thank you so much, Peter, for those insights. Peter Major, Director for Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions, joining us to unpack the relationship between gold and silver and understand the gold-silver ratio.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
Ready to take control of your financial future? Moneyversity Plus is your go-to streaming edutainment platform for all ages. With fun, engaging content and downloads for kids ages 6 to 17 and practical lessons for adults of all ages, Moneyversity Plus makes learning about money easy and exciting for everyone in the family. Plus, as you learn, you can earn Old Mutual Rewards points, a win for your wallet and a win for your future. Whether it's mastering money basics or planning your financial goals, Moneyversity has you covered. Start streaming today and join thousands of others at moneyversity.co.za. Your plus one for financial wisdom.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Tomorrow is arguably the second biggest day in the world of financial markets in relation to South Africa. It's the day we have the finance minister deliver his midterm budget policy statement. I say the second biggest day because the only real thing bigger than that is budget day. But we are going to be focusing on that. We're going to be looking ahead to the expectations tomorrow. We've got a special budget show lined up tomorrow. We're going to be doing a double bill on the afternoon show, the National Pulse, with Ashraf Garda, as well as on our evening show. We're going to be unpacking the midterm budget policy statement and what was said. But we can't do that without knowing what to expect. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Christy Viljoen, senior economist at PwC, to take a look at some of the budget expectations, or at least the midterm budget expectations. Good evening, Dr. Viljoen. Lovely to speak to you again. Tomorrow is the first midterm budget policy statement of the government of national unity, the government of coalitions, whatever we're calling it. It's the first time we're getting this joint statement in this format in 30 years. What are we expecting?
Well, we're hoping for more of the same. Apart from generally wanting that, when you hear budget speeches, you don't want to see something shocking or out of the ordinary. You want things to be predictable, stable, etc. So apart from wanting that, we can also understand that most of the major parties within the government of national unity have similar fiscal goals. We want to invest in infrastructure. We want to spend money on social needs. We want to pay social transfers. So I'm not expecting anything different from the finance minister than what he probably would have spoken about in Feb, except some of the number details, because the fiscal policy or fiscal philosophy of the GNU is not that much different from the one that we had previously.
When we look at that fiscal policy, Christy, there are obviously some outstanding issues that the National Treasury has had to juggle for the last couple of budget statements, and we've had some issues added to that. So I'm thinking about things like stabilizing the debt to GDP ratio, managing our long-term debt objectives, recently getting us off grey listing that we've now been added onto. Are you expecting that a lot of these will be addressed and dealt with? We know in the main budget that took place in February, there was a conversation around these are serious pressing issues. And this is kind of really the first time we're going to get an update on those.
Yeah, look, those serious pressing issues have been around for a while. So the grey listing, we've had that for the past 2 years. The increase in debt has been around since before COVID, actually. And it's one of our biggest challenges because every year when we plan where the budget is going, the assumption on where the economy is going is a bit optimistic. So we're thinking economic growth is going to be better than it's probably going to pan out to be. That means that our revenues are going to be less than expected. The tax revenues collected by SARS and government. In the end, our fiscal deficit is either bigger or we need to cut spending. And all of those things feed into debt continuing to rise. Now, we've always had, for many years now, we've had this plan that over the next 3 years, debt will peak as a percentage of GDP, stabilize, and then come back down. But that's moved out it feels like almost every time there's a budget, we've got this three-year plan. And so there's talk about having some kind of mechanism that puts a ceiling on debt. And to get that done, you'll have to rein in spending. Now, that's a difficult one. Another key thing that's been around for a long time is the cost of the public sector wage bill. It has been coming down as a percentage of total spending, but still, we know that at the moment there are negotiations on the go, and I think at this point, government and Labour is quite wide apart from where they should be. So, honestly, it's the same kind of big-ticket items that we've had to sort out for quite some time, and unfortunately, I'm thinking that on many of them, we're going to hear that we'll give more details or we'll give solutions in February. That's often the challenge with this medium-term budget. The big decisions are made in February with the main budget. So I'm thinking we're not going to get all the solutions we need. We're probably going to kick some of them down the road still.
I wonder if it might be time to change that as well. Now would be as good a time as any to start splitting the big news items between the two budgets. One of those items that came up earlier this week was the ANC's Economic Transformation Committee, or the subcommittee rather, announcing that they had plans, from a government perspective at least, to expand the zero-rated VAT food basket. Now, I wonder if we'll get those VAT announcements, because we don't typically see major tax announcements happen at the midterm budget policy statement. But it's interesting that the timing of the statement by the ANC lines up with a couple of days before the budget. What do you make of that, Christy?
No, that's true. I mean, there's pressure from everywhere to do this specific action, because we know that when you take VAT away, immediately there's a big price difference that can kick in. And it's been a while since we've revised this list of VAT-free products. And some of the big ones up at the moment would be different kinds of chicken products, which is a staple food. It's the number one protein in the country. You would really impact the average person by bringing down the cost of chicken by removing VAT. So there's pressure from all kinds of directions. Again, adjustment to the VAT system, the VAT rate or the VAT list, those always happen in Feb. And I would agree with you. It's actually a good time to do it now, because people are struggling. Yes, they will still be struggling in Feb, but we could win quite a few months, actually, if we think about this. Now, that obviously doesn't take into account the processes that government needs to go through to look at these things and approve them. So I'm thinking, again, it's going to be a bit too quick. We'll probably have to wait till Feb, but I'm sure the finance minister is going to speak about this, because it's one of our key cost of living challenges right now, alongside the issue of the fuel price, which we've also heard for quite some time is going to be changed with the calculation. Putting my bets on February, to be very honest, but the finance minister must speak on these topics. That's essential.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how that all shapes up. I'm sure you and I will catch up after the budget to try and dissect the things that left us happy, sad, and probably disappointed. For now, we'll leave it at that. Christy, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Dr. Christy Fulhuin, Senior Economist at PwC, joining us to share his budget expectations ahead of tomorrow's midterm budget policy statement.
What happens when you cross the finish line? As you reach retirement, your life will change. Your investments should too. Wherever you are in life, we have an investment solution for you. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is proudly sponsored by Old Mutual, headline sponsor for the 2024 Singularity U Summit. We've often heard that SMEs are the lifeblood of the economy, particularly in the South African context. And as someone who's started one or two businesses in his time, I can certainly attest to the fact that SMEs play a crucial role in growing economies, in fostering development, and in providing innovative solutions to problems. But the nice thing about a show like ours is you don't have to take my word for it. There are seasoned experts that happen to share the same opinion. I'm joined on the line by the director for SME at Old Mutual, a corporate, Nobesuthu Ndlovu, to take a look at the power of SMEs and the role that they play in a country's economy and in the country's growth prospects. Good evening, Nobesuthu. Thanks so much for taking the time. I don't need to be convinced around SMEs, but for those that are still on the fence, what would some of the main reasons be behind companies getting involved in SMEs and the need for SMEs in our economy?
Sure. I'm also, like you, super passionate, and also have run my own business in my personal capacity. And what I know for sure is that we are in a crisis as South Africa, because our unemployment rate is actually leaving people at home and in a situation where they cannot participate in the economy. Now, if they're not participating in the economy, they are causing chaos. I'm being extremely simplistic in that particular point. But this is why SMEs are actually so important, because business owners are the people that are creating the jobs that we need. And it is through SMEs that we're going to solve for the employment crisis that we have in South Africa. If I look at, on average, the number of businesses that are employing people, it's in the range of, you know, on a business per business, at least they employ 1 to 5 people. So absolutely, SMEs, if anybody doesn't believe why we should be focusing on small and medium enterprises, it should be for the one reason that is around the economic and employment challenge that we have.
And that employment challenge is a serious challenge that we have to tackle and address, because the fact that it is still north of 30% is the most worrying statistic that we should all be contending with. Nobesuthu, I want to look at the challenges that SMEs face, because it's all good and well to say that there are challenges that exist within the economy and within the world, but SMEs themselves face their own sets of challenges. And as I say this, I think about every single SME I've spoken to, every business I've started. Chief among these challenges arguably has to be financial challenges.
Absolutely. So there are a few. I'll categorize them into a few buckets. The first is getting access to funding. So not necessarily finding out where funding is, but getting approved for funding is an extremely hard situation for businesses. I mean, if we look at during COVID, when businesses were applying for funding that should have had a slightly more relaxed criteria, there was this 0% approval rate, which is actually systemic as it relates to just applying for funding in general. So that's a big challenge, that ability to get approved and knowing how to carve your business out so that you are funding ready, so to speak. So I think that's a big one. The second big
business owners' challenges are threefold. So the first one is around getting access to funding. There is funding that is available, but actually getting approved is where the access part is a big challenge for businesses. And if we look at the COVID stats or COVID funding applications and approvals that were received, there was about a 5% approval ratio. And that's with slightly relaxed terms. So that tells you the major systemic challenges that businesses have in actually getting approval for funding. And the second challenge is around getting access to a client base and growing the client base. So, you know, growing your client base may be growing locally or internationally. So just that journey of how do I expand my business at scale and at speed is a big challenge for business owners. And then the third aspect is, or the third challenge is around time. A lot of business owners are running their businesses with themselves, doing the majority of the HR, the legal, the accounting side of things, not from a lack of knowing that they should hire people to help them with this, but there is a catch-22 as it relates to cash flow and being able to hire those people to come in and do the work versus you doing the work yourself. So this has lent business owners to actually spend 70% of their time on business administration activities and only 30% of their time on growing their business and looking for new customers and new markets.
Nobesuthu, when we look at these pain points that SMEs are experiencing, why is it essential that we actually address them if we hope to have a sustainable culture of strong businesses that are employing people on a sustainable basis?
It's essential because business owners cannot do this alone. it is essential that we as large corporates participate in a meaningful way. That's why I'm quite excited about my work that I'm doing here at Old Mutual, to really be an enabler and a catalyst for growth. It's essential for us as consumers to buy SME and local products so that we can actually grow our economy. It's essential for governments to participate in enabling and creating laws and policies that create an environment that really harnesses the growth of business owners. With all of us, these three participants, large corporates, the consumers and government, all participating in enabling business SMEs to grow, really enables a stronger economy and decreases our unemployment rate and makes for a better country for all of us to live in.
We'll get to some of the initiatives that you have ongoing at Old Mutual in a second. I want to look at the holistic value proposition and the holistic proposition around sustainability, because even if we solve these problems, we don't want to be solving them as a once-off, right? And I understand that you and the team at Old Mutual have sort of three pillars that you put into this holistic proposition. I want to get a better sense of what that looks like and why those are the cardinal pillars.
So the three pillars are based on the three challenges that we actually discussed earlier. And, you know, you touch on the theme of sustainability. I love it, because what we are, our vision and our end state is that we want to enable businesses to be highly profitable. Because if they're profitable, they can continue to grow and they can continue to employ people in their companies. So that's our end state. And if we're to work backwards and start with the theme of efficiencies in a business, what we're solving for and how we're solving for efficiencies is by creating a digital platform that effectively enables businesses to run and grow their business on this platform, effectively saving them time to do the mundane elements. And some of these examples are, for example, we've got an HR capability on the platform. And what the HR capability enables businesses to do is to create payslips / payroll requirements, manage timesheets, manage staff, and manage leave and all the elements that really relate to the human resource capability. And the staff members can also access the system to be able to log leave and also engage with it on an HR level. So that's just one example of the many administrative activities. Maybe let me just state the others. It's the legal aspect, and it is invoices, quotes, statements of accounts, product and inventory management. So that's really an element that says, if we can digitize, which we have, we can save you time as a business owner so that you can then focus on growing your business through increasing your client base, which leads me to the second way in terms of how we're solving for this. We've created a marketplace on our digital platform where businesses are able to upload their products and services so that they're able to sell to other businesses. But more importantly, we're also exposing SMEs to large corporates, and we're starting with Old Mutual. What that looks like is where Old Mutual actually will provide a view in terms of the RFPs, RFQs that we have, where we're looking for service providers. And we are then exposing our businesses, SMEs that are registered on the platform, to be able to participate in that process with a view of what are the requirements that Old Mutual has. And we're looking to other large corporates that we'll be partnering with to join in this effort in terms of being a procurer of products and services from SMEs. So that's the second aspect in terms of how we're solving. Then the third aspect is, once you've got your efficiency sorted and once you've got your sales increased, right, that makes for a better net profit and ultimately improves your balance sheet, which then enables the ability to have a better potential for a positive outcome in terms of a funding application. And what I love in particular about our funding solution is that we provide a multitude of lending products that businesses actually need, such as purchase order finance, such as supply chain finance, such as invoice discounting, all in an attempt to enable businesses to get approved for funding by having a better understanding of what is involved in the value chain and in the running of a business, and hence these products are tailored towards that.
The world is changing, opportunities are aplenty, and the African continent will not be left behind. I think we'll leave it at that. Nobisuthu, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Nobisuthu Ndlovu, Director for SME at Old Mutual Corporate, on the innovations and solutions they have for SMEs. This interview was proudly sponsored by Old Mutual, headline sponsor for the 2024 Singularity U Summit. Ready to take control of your financial future? Moneyversity Plus is your go-to streaming edutainment platform for all ages. With fun, engaging content and downloads for kids ages 6 to 17 and practical lessons for adults of all ages, Moneyversity Plus makes learning about money easy and exciting for everyone in the family. Plus, as you learn, you can earn Old Mutual Rewards points, a win for your wallet and a win for your future. Whether it's mastering money basics or planning your financial goals, Moneyversity has you covered. Start streaming today and join thousands of others at moneyversity.co.za. Your plus one for financial wisdom.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's the last Property Tuesday for the month of October, and we're taking a look at a very interesting rental monitor report that was put together by the guys at a TPN around the state of the rental market for the second quarter of 2024. I'm joined on the line by the marketing director at TPN, Valdu Marcus, to take a look at this report and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Valdu. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about the residential rental monitor report. Why did you guys put that together, and kind of what does the report aim to achieve?
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners. The TPN Residential Rental Monitor is produced on a quarterly basis, and we look at various data points that we collect from the residential rental market, and that data is submitted to the Credit Bureau from a wide range of organizations, all the way down to, you know, a small individual landlord that might be having an apartment or a couple of rooms that they rent out. And that data is then collected, and we produce the residential rental monitor, and that gives us a good indication of the overall success of the sector or potential challenges that they face, but also gives us a very good insight into the consumer and the strains and potential stresses that they are under. And this residential rental monitor is always led by the tenants in good standing, and a tenant is classified in good standing if they have met their full rental obligation by the end of the month. And that really gives us a good indication of how tenants are paying. And then as we drill down, it also speaks to the escalations, so rental growth within the sector, as well as rental distribution, so which rental value bands perform, which provinces are in high demand. And then we also go into a lot more detail around specific provinces' average rentals, as well as the investor market and how that is the composition thereof. And again, that is really to provide the sector, landlords, property investors, large institutional investors, the overall health check of how the sector is performing.
Valdu, how is the sector performing? How are rentals at the moment? I know interest rates have been high for quite some time and they're only starting to come down now, but how are renters feeling and how are tenants feeling about the property market at the moment?
We cannot speak about the residential rental market or any type of property without touching on interest rates. And interest rates being elevated for the past 18 months have really seen consumers under pressure and therefore their household budgets under pressure. But overall, we've seen that 83% of tenants are in good standing, and that's the national average, and it's slightly up from the previous quarter of 82.83%. Now, consider during the pandemic in 2020, the national average was at 73%. So we've really seen tenants remain committed, although their household budgets remain under strain, not just due to the cost of debt, but also very high inflation, fuel prices, transport costs, rates and taxes, all have increased, all in the double digits. However, it appears that tenants remain very committed to ensure that they maintain the roof over their heads. And then on the other side, landlords have also shown their commitment and appreciation for the challenges that households face by not increasing escalations aggressively, as they balance between keeping a property occupied and ensuring they have consistent cash flow, ensuring that the tenant can afford it, and therefore providing a slightly lower escalation than what we've seen a couple of years ago, pre-2020. And that's really boded well for vacancy rates in South Africa. It ensured that tenants remain in good standing. And yes, there is differences in provinces, and there's also differences in rental value bands. But overall, it seems to be that the residential rental market is performing very well, and we expect it to continue, especially now with interest rates coming down. We're seeing there's a lot of optimism around economic growth, and that will drive more jobs. So overall, it seems to be a good picture that this rental monitor is providing us.
Valdo, are there some concerns that exist in the market? I mean, obviously, with the amount of data you're able to collect, you're able to see if there are any areas in the market that might be under a bit of pressure. Are there any interesting insights that might be giving you cause for concern at this stage?
I think looking at the different rental value bands, and we measure that specifically to look at what rental stock is in demand, and then, of course, which sector of the market is struggling. Those paying less than 3,000 Rand a month for their rental property, they're sitting at a 70.41% good standing. So that means 7 out of 10 of those tenants are in good standing. When we move up slightly to the 3,000 to 7,000 Rand rental mark, we're seeing that at 82.17%. Those paying between 7 and 12,000, that is the best performing rental value band in South Africa. That's almost 90%. That's 88.5% of those tenants in good standing. So almost 9 out of 10 tenants in that specific rental value band is in good standing. Then we've got the 12 to 25,000. So we're going towards the more luxury rental markets. We're seeing 88.24%, so slightly under that 7 to 12,000 Rand rental mark. And then the luxury rental market, which is 25,000 Rand or more a month, is sitting at 82.29%. So it's between the 12,000 or 25,000 or more and the 3 and 7,000 that takes the second lowest rental good standing in South Africa. But again, going into the detail of the data, is it shows that those in the luxury rental market, they are paying late, but they are still meeting their rental obligations. While if we look at the lower rental value bands at 3,000 or less, we're seeing that almost 15% of tenants are making no payments towards their rental obligations, while only 54% are paying on time. And then the difference between that is grace periods that's afforded by landlords, or paying late, or only making a partial payment. So it still shows that the lower income group is struggling to make ends meet, and it's completely understandable considering they have less disposable income to buffer against these very high increases in living costs.
Valdo, what about the investor side of it? People that might be looking to get into rental property as an investor, or that might have recently gotten in, how are those prospects shaping up at the moment? Is now the right time to be looking at rental properties from an investment point of view?
That's always a very, very difficult question to answer without looking specifically at certain locations within South Africa. And within certain provinces, there's certain municipalities and cities that really perform very, very well. That's got very low vacancies. You've got good capital growth. You've got good rental growth. You've got tenants that's committed. But those you need to find and specifically look for. But an interesting thing that we've picked up during this research is we also looked at the natural persons that are investors. So these are individuals that own property on their personal name. So it's identified by an ID or a passport. And we've seen a change in the composition of those type of investors. We've seen that in the past, it was predominantly dominated by male investors. You know, during 1995, 1996, 58% were male. And as we then started going into 2001, we saw more and more women investing. And in 2024, females surpassed the number of males that is investing in their personal capacity. And various reasons around it, but I think the main driver is barriers to entry, you know, equal pay and better job opportunities for women in South Africa. And we've really seen that women were turning towards property both for a second home, so capital growth as a form of saving, but also to drive rental incomes. What we also picked up is that the composition, so the size of portfolios for those natural persons, in the past, the majority, there was quite a large chunk that owned 10 or more properties. And that's really declined over the years. And more we see these micro investors that own one or two to three to four properties in South Africa. Again, there's also other factors that play a role in that, including private companies, which holds the assets as well as trusts. Now, these numbers that I've given you does not include those specific. We really looked at natural persons, so that owns small portfolios and how that composition have changed. So other factors that could be driving it is yes, the companies that's more tax efficient and trust that's more tax efficient provides a lot more security as well as a bit of protection. But that composition has changed. And that means also that we have a bigger diverse group of people investing in property than what we've seen a couple of decades ago.
Certainly some interesting insights from the rental space. Lots to consider if someone is looking at that space, whether as an investor or as a tenant. But we'll leave it at that, Voldu. Thanks so much for the insights. Voldu Marcus, Marketing Director at TPN, on their rental report for the second quarter of 2024. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hoss is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. If you've missed any of our conversations, you know where to catch up on them. But after Greg Hoss, you've got the company of Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.